Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I've been here for a week already. There was a conference here which was absolutely very, very exciting. And I'm delighted to be here today to speak to this audience. You may wonder what it means to say from Hubert's Museum to Science at Small Scales, and that's sort of the hook, you know, for this talk. Before I start it, though, I want to say that I will talk briefly, albeit briefly, about a number of things which have been helped by a disparate group of people who come from varying disciplines. I myself am a physicist, so whenever I start talking about anything having to do with chemistry, which I may do in one or two slides, you'll forgive me if I don't know very much about it. I'll have the physicist's point of view. In any case, this is the group of people who I have to be grateful to. So the first part of this talk is going to be background introduction, then I'm going to talk briefly about magnetic sensors, then electric sensors, and finally I will talk about patterning and controlled activation of biomotors. Now all of these different subjects depend on their being at small scales. And the reason for that is that I hope to be able to point out magnetic sensors are necessary for doing all kinds of sensing at very small scales when you have micro beads and things to look like that to look for. So let me start with the introduction then. Okay, now this is Hubert's Museum. That's what it looked like roughly in 1947. Hubert's Museum was on 42nd Street in New York City. I came to the city in 1947. I had come from Europe, and I was quite a small boy in those days, but my mother, she worked in nightclubs, so they lived on 83rd Street, my mother lived on 83rd Street, and I lived on 78th Street in a rooming house where I was above my grandmother, a lovely lady, but she was slightly deaf, couldn't see too well, and in the evening she enjoyed to have a drink every once in a while, which gave me an enormous amount of freedom when I first came to this country. And among the things that I did is I used to sneak out of the house, and then we would hang on the back of the buses that ran from Broadway on 78th Street down to 42nd Street. And one of the places that we used to love to go were Hubert's Museum. It has, as you can see, it was the home of the trained flea circus, for example. It also had various other fascinating things, you know, especially for a 12-year-old boy. And so I loved going there. I really did. And I went there often. But one of the things that they had there was a microscope, and they had a pin. And you could look through the microscope, and engraved on the pin was the Lord's Prayer. And that was actually a very fascinating thing in those days, you know, especially for a young kid. And it always got me wondering, you know, how can they possibly do that? And I would like to say that this was an inspiration to me. No. Nonetheless, I come back to it now because what I would like to talk about, and this was the segue into what I'm going to talk about, which is science at small scales. So I talked about the Lord's Prayer. So the next question is, can we put a physics book on the head of a pin? Or for that matter, of an encyclopedia. If you consider a physicist's book, it's square. It is 10 inches by 10 inches, this page. Let's say it's 1,000 pages. That's 10 to the fifth square inches is the area of all of the pages. And if you consider the head of a pin, well, if you work it out, it's roughly in diameter 3 times 10 to the minus third square inches. And that means that you either have to shrink or you have to increase the linear dimension by a factor of 5.5 times 10 to the third. That means if I wanted to put all of this on a page so that I could all shrink it down, I would have to decrease everything by 5.5 times 10 to the third linearly. That doesn't sound so bad. You know, it might be able to be done. And in fact, if you were to take an Encyclopedia Britannica, you can do the same kind of calculation. It would be 12 to 25 volumes. You would have 25 times 10 to the fifth square inches divided by 3 times 10 to the minus 3, and you would come up with an area multiplier of 8 times 10 to the eighth, or a linear dimensional change, which is only a magnitude greater than for only one encyclopedia. So that makes sense, and the question is can we actually do that? Well, I don't know. Let's just first look at the resolving power of the eye. It's about 1/120th of an inch, and if we wanted to put, you know, the Encyclopedia Britannica on the pin, we would have to demagnify by 3 × 10⁴, as I mentioned to you a moment ago, and that means that also the resolving power would have to be decreased by that much. So that means roughly 70 to 80 angstroms. 70 to 80 angstroms. That would be the kind of change that we would have to make. An angstrom is 10 to the minus 8 centimeters, and it turns out that the diameter of an average atom is about 3 angstroms, so it would be about 25 angstroms across. Thus, the area would be approximately 625 angstroms, and that means there's plenty of information if we were able to manipulate atoms. Now, this is the argument which is very, very famous, in fact. Well, I have some units here. I think you have already heard from the previous speakers a lot of the units. I may use things like, for example, micron, a nanometer, an angstrom, as you can see up there. And so you see, you know, what that means in terms of meters. I will probably not look at the larger scales today. But the guy who actually did that, and he was already mentioned in the first talk, is Richard Feynman. And he had this very, very famous talk, which he gave at an APS meeting on December 26, 1959, which he called, "There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom." And this was exactly the argument that he gave that I actually outlined to you right now. And you can see that it was reprinted actually in the Journal of Microelectromechanical Systems, Volume 1, Number 1, in 1992. And I don't think if that journal exists anymore, but you can get it on the web. I mean, it's an absolutely wonderful article, and it shows that this man, who was just such a giant and such an imaginative person, was able to think in many, many different areas. And he was the motivator, I think, for much of what we are going to hear about today. Well, he went on to talk about what happens if you wanted to take all the written knowledge in the world. In 1959, that was a lot smaller than it is now. He thought that there would be 25 million volumes, which means if we translate it into pinheads, it would be 1 million pinheads or 1,000 pinheads on a side. So the total area, if you then demagnify, would be roughly on the order of 3 square yards. All the knowledge would be able to be put on there. And then finally, I just want to point out the one thing that he also did. He said, supposing we weren't talking about areal density, supposing we were talking about volume density, he also calculated, as you can see up there, he said, okay, if we have a certain number of bits that are necessary to make a letter, then that would be roughly on the order of 100 atoms each bit. And he estimated, although I don't know how he did that, that the number of bits necessary for 25 million volumes, but you heard that there are many, many more bits that are being created every year, every day now, that would be on the order of 10 to the 15th. The number of atoms necessary is then 10 to the 17th. And the density of a metal, that is the number of atoms per cubic centimeter, is roughly between 10 to the 22nd and 10 to the 23rd. And so we find that, you know, all the knowledge in the world at that time could have been put in a three-dimensional little cube, which is, you know, 1/100th of a centimeter on each side. That was his argument. And that's a very impressive argument that he made there. Because then all he said is that for biology, of course, knows that because the genetic makeup is carried in minute quantities as we now know. So I thought I would give you that argument because it's been such a powerful one that was made long before anybody knew how to do all of that. And of course, what we're doing now, most of us, is we are trying to learn how to make things small, how to read things when they're very small, how to manipulate things when they're very small. And so I'll spend the next few minutes anyway, or next half hour, talking about some of that. Well, I think you know, of course, what the nanoscale represents. It's about this. We can talk about bacteria, viruses, all kinds of things, small molecules, atoms. But this gives you some scale of what we're interested in looking at. Well, I'm not going to talk about this very much. This has been already mentioned many times. This was the first transistor, actually, that was ever made. Its speed was very low. Its size was pretty large. And as you can see, it cost a great deal per transistor. And this was done at Bell Labs. Nowadays, of course, and I think these are old numbers, they're probably not useful anymore. It's probably much better than that. We have speeds, you know, of nanohertz, I mean, of 10 to the 9 hertz. We have sizes which are on the order of nanometers, tenths of microns, and much, much less now. We are all approaching things that are on the order of, you know, 10 angstroms, you know, 10 nanometers, 10 nanometers resolution. Line widths are possible now. And the costs are far, far smaller. Well, I don't think I'll talk about that. Again, there is a much more recent curve that you saw earlier today given by Stu Wolf. But one thing I can tell you is I used to work at the IBM Corporation. And when I first went there, which was in 1965, all of the computing was done in an enormous room that was about the size of this whole room. And there were a large number of tapes whirring about. You know, they had large stacks of enormous plates on which information was stored. And people were there, you know, to move things from one place to another so they could be put into the area where actual computation could be done. They had a lot of people who had to work there. And of course, nowadays, you know, we have something which is, and this is again far, far smaller than what Stu was saying, but it's just absolutely amazing the progress that has been made. Well, so let me go on now and talk briefly about magnetic sensors, because one of the things, the motivation for that is that, you know, we talked about recording before. You heard two talks, the first of which was really on recording. And in that case, the bits were actually small magnetic films which are horizontal. But there's now a big push to try to do vertical recording. And so it's very interesting to see whether or not, as was said earlier, whether these vertical bits of information can actually be stable. Will they interact with one another? Because there's little magnets that are going to sit there. And will they interact with one another? Will they fluctuate so much that they will not remain in the same state? All of these are questions that had to be answered, and we don't really know all that much about vertical recording, although there's a great deal of that work going on in industry. But I'll talk about something that we ourselves do a great deal of, which is we use an effect called the Hall effect. The Hall effect is an effect that if you apply a magnetic field vertically to a material, in our case, this is a rather sophisticated piece of semiconducting material, and you produce a current in this direction, then there will be a deflection and a Hall voltage will be produced. And this voltage is going to be proportional to the amount of magnetic field that is threading this piece of a semiconductor. And so if you know everything else about the material, like its carrier concentration, various other things, then you can use this as a very sensitive magnetometer. We do something a little bit more unconventional. We have here a rather nice semiconducting substrate. We have the Hall effect, which we actually etch into the system with various techniques. The dimensions here are close to 1 micron now, and we can place small magnetic particles on one of those crosses. It's a specific kind of Hall device which gets rid of all extraneous fields, like, for example, you know, the Earth's magnetic field, so on, so that you can only see what's really on one of the crosses compared to the other. So that's what I'm showing here. here are these things. This is what the material is made out of. It's actually a very complex stack of material. I'm not going to go into the details, but actually the sensing layer is the one that's right here. It's sort of buried below the surface of the material. And here is one of these Hall crosses as they are made when we use photolithography, which is a lithography whereby we put a pattern on a semiconductor and we can then etch it in various different ways. What you see here is one of these crosses. And there are two, of course, for the device that I'm showing. And then the way we put the magnetic particles on there, and what I'm doing here is I'm going through a variety of techniques which had to be invented in order to make, you know, very, very small particles, to place them where we want them, to do what we want to do with them. This was done with a so-called scanning tunneling microscope. Some of you may have seen pictures of how people have been able to manipulate single atoms using these scanning tunneling microscopes. We don't use it for that purpose. We have it in ultra-high vacuum, and what we have here is one of these microscopes. We have a little tip, and we have a rather poisonous, very poisonous precursor molecule here that's iron carbonyl. And if we put a modest voltage between the tip and the substrate upon which we want to grow these guys, then that turns out to be about, you know, 18 volts or so. And you can then produce actual aerial sort of arrays of this sort. This happens to be an atomic micrograph of an array of some roughly 10 by 10. And these are now, because, and you learned this earlier today, in iron, because these are pillars, the anisotropy, that is where the magnetization wants to be, is completely dominated by the shape of it. So here you have these very, very fine wires of magnetic iron, and so the magnetization will be either in this direction or it'll be in the opposite direction. And what you want to be able to do is you want to be able to switch them the way you want to do them, because that gives you information. Either it's a yes or it's a no, or it's a one or it's a zero. And the question is, how does that switching occur? And does it occur differently depending on how close these are to each other, and how large they are, and this? And that's the kind of work that we had been doing and we continue to do. I'm not going to go into the details of that, but I wanted to show you that you have to have special techniques to make these small things. The dimensions here are very small. The spacing between these is about 300 nanometers, nanometer being 10 to the minus 9 meters. So these are about 300 or 3,000 angstroms, perhaps, is the better way to say it. And so here they are. They have lengths which are roughly 80 to 100 nanometers, and the diameter that's actually of the iron is actually very small. It's of order maybe 10 nanometers. Okay, so it's 100 angstroms, so maybe 30 angstroms across. So, all right. This is what one of these things looks like. It's a much, much longer than it would ordinarily be, because we used it in order to use a technique called transmission electron microscopy to look at the what's inside this carbonaceous crust. And these black things, look sort of like pearls. These are small iron crystallites which are all connected to one another, making this long iron fiber. And you have to have it very thin in order to have the electrons go through so you can actually see that. So we would like to be able to improve the sensitivities of these magnetometers. And the way one can do that, let me just show you that, is supposing we have such a magnetic pillar. Then what we can do is we can actually have it be above the sensing part of this Hall device, and we can calculate what the magnetic fields are due to that. Many of you know that if you have a magnet like this, then there will be a dipole field which goes like this and like that. And this is the field distribution that one can calculate for specific dimensions. And I think you can also see that if we make the dimensions of our hall cross, that is the dimension of this here, smaller, then the average field that this thing is going to see is going to be greater, and so we would like to miniaturize our hall devices. So once again, making things smaller makes our device more sensitive. Well, this just shows that the average magnetic field that's seen by a Hall device looking at one of these pillars will increase as we get to smaller and smaller channel widths. The channel width is this width over here. But it turns out that the sensitivity of the device actually doesn't do that. It actually peters out. It gets smaller. So we operate ordinarily at about, 500 nanometer channel width for most of the things that we do. And we've been able to actually make very sensitive Hall magnetometers. And we need to be able to do that, and as I'll show a little bit later on, also to try to measure small magnetic beads for possible biomedical applications. So there we are. This is now in gallium aluminum arsenide, gallium arsenide heterostructures. And we can measure one, in fact, of these small, tiny particles, or two. This is little particle A, this is little particle B. It is about 1 micron, this is a micron scale, so this dimension here is of order maybe 500 to 700 nanometers. And as you can see, even one or two of these very small particles can be observed by these very sensitive magnetometers, and this is the so-called hysteresis curve of such a magnet, which means that basically as I sweep the magnetic field, and if my magnetization of my particle is like this, and I now invert the magnetic field, I go to a large enough field, then it'll switch. And that's what you see here. So what's happening is as I go along here, maybe it's in this position, and then it'll switch to the other position. This is just like looking at the magnetization, although it is the Hall voltage from this device. So we want to also make use of these things for biological applications. So one of the things that I wanted to point out is that, in my view anyway, the sciences are going to become increasingly interdisciplinary. So we, for example, are extremely interested in the interface between soft and hard condensed matter. By that I mean we can take devices like these Hall devices and we could put up on them, soft materials like biological molecules, and perhaps as a solid state or condensed matter physicist, I can then make use of the devices that we have here to understand something about an entirely different field. And so there's a lot of that going on, and I wanted to give you a few examples of that. So here, what we want to do is we want to use these devices, which I hope I've now explained to you. This is, once again, if we have a magnetic field, we can create a voltage which can be measured if we have a current going through the device. The relationship is that the Hall voltage is given by some constant times the current that we're putting through it times the field that's in the direction perpendicular to the device. Now, if we have receptor molecules, which by some means we would be able to position exactly on these small devices, and remember what I told you, this is of order, 1 micron or less. That's not easy to do. You want to only put it there. You don't want to put it anywhere else. Then we have to develop new techniques for doing that. And then we can take target molecules, the ones that we actually want to find, and the red parts will contact one another. There it goes. Yeah, there he is. And then we want to decorate it with a magnetic bead. And the reason we want to decorate it with a magnetic bead is because that magnetic particle will have a dipole field which can be sensed by that Hall device. These beads are very small. They can be of order 1 micron or so, but depending on the kind of molecules that we want to sense, we will have to decrease the bead size accordingly. And if we want to decrease the bead size, then we have to increase the sensitivity of our Hall device, and that means that we have to shrink it even further, as I mentioned to you a moment ago. So there we are. So now those are the dipole fields. The main advantages over non-magnetic and substrate-free sensing schemes is that they can be integrated. But most importantly, the sensor is sensitive enough, we would like to make it to detect the small stray field from that label. I think we can do that. So that's we're working very hard on that. But now let me just say a few words about how we might be able to actually put particular molecules on a solid-state device. And here I need the help, in fact, more than the help, I need the education from our chemists, our biochemists, and our biologists. And since I'm none of those, I will not be able to tell you very much about that, except to say, for example, if we have on our Hall device a gold layer, which we ordinarily do, then there's a well-known effect that occurs if we put a sulfur chain, a sulfur radical, on the bottom of these long chains. The chains themselves may have different functions, but if you can so-called thiolate it, you can put a sulfur group on the bottom, it tends to attach itself to the gold. And then one can play all kinds of different games, depending on how smart a chemist or biochemist you are, in order to attach to these various things that we're interested in. But it's a convenient pathway for integration of organic solid materials, and so this is something that there's a great deal of work going on in trying to define what molecules will attach to what other molecules and so on. Now, we can also use stamps. They're just like the stamps that you use on larger scales. And these stamps can be inked with a molecular ink. And for example, here we have a pattern, and the size here is 2 micrometers. And this is just a pattern which has been stamped. We can also do something else. That's called Dippen nanolithography. One can take one of these scanning tunneling microscope tips. Perhaps you've heard of the scanning tunneling microscope. I mentioned it to you earlier, where they can manipulate atoms. You can take one of those tips and then coat it with the molecule of interest. And it works just like a pen. Of course, the chemistry involved in actually making the coating such that it will stick to the bottom rather than sticking to the tip is not non-conventional, is rather more challenging. But if you can do that, then you can also pattern very, very small patterns very, very close to where you want them. So these are all the things that we can do in order to pattern our crosses. We can also learn how to measure them. And we measure these by using various techniques. That is, we use an AC magnetic field in addition to a DC magnetic field. I won't go into the details for that, but the end result is the one that I want to show you here. Here you have one of these Hall crosses. It's 1 micron in diameter here. And the bead itself is approximately 1.2 microns. These are commercial beads which are now available to decorate organic molecules and biomolecules. And the question is, can we actually see a signal from this? And it turns out that we can. The signal that we see is in fact very large. It has so-called signal-to-noise ratio of 50, which means that we should be able to see much, much smaller beads using this technique and this setup altogether. So we're on our way of trying to look for smaller beads. In fact, what's happened here is the way we put that bead on there was with micromanipulators, but that really doesn't do us any good if we're trying to use it, you know, for biomolecular applications. So we need to do something a little bit better. And so I'll just go very briefly through this. So you can make molecular patterns. For example, this is on a piece of gold. We can put material here, which is basically these are organics which are hydrophobic. They don't like water. And then they have hydrophilic ones, which are the brown dots. And to those, we can attach various particles. For example, we can attach iron oxide. You heard about that in the second talk today. That's magnetite. And this is the preferred material, actually, to be used for these small beads, these here. And when you do that, then what you see is that you can actually decorate this with these little magnetite particles. And these are really, they're less than a micron diameter. They're still quite a number of particles. But the point is, as you put them wherever you want them. So this is a very nice way of doing self-assembly, so-called, of nanoparticles by using various molecular recognition schemes. This is a bit of a larger, well, this is not a photograph. This is actually a lateral force microscope image, which shows where the pattern is under which we want to put our small iron oxide particle. And this is the Hall cross, as you can see over here. And as you can see from this, the viscosity, actually the sticking coefficient, is different for the different things that we put on there, and that gives this contrast. So this contrast here in white means that we have something which will be hydrophilic. It can actually attach to these things. And then the other one is hydrophobic. If you once do that and you allow a solution of iron oxide particles to flow over this small Hall device, and remember that this is a micron or two, then you can actually capture a small iron oxide nanoparticle, as you can see over here. So this type of scheme actually works pretty well, although not always. So what are we going to do in the future for these kinds of things? Well, we would like to be able to fabricate smaller devices. We need to improve our detection methods. I won't go into that, but the end result is that we think that we'll be able to see cobalt nanoparticles, although you never want to use those in anybody because they're highly poisonous. Nonetheless, you know, as a proof of concept, we can use these small cobalt particles, which are about 10 nanometers in diameter, and we expect to be able to see approximately 6 of those, and maybe even one of those in the very near future. So we're very highly hopeful with the material that we have here that we'll be able to do that. And of course, in order to be able to do this efficiently, we also have to be able to get the material, the biomaterial, to it. And again, so that means that we have to work with engineers, we have to work with condensed matter physicists, we have to work with biologists in order to try to make these devices. And it's all at a very small scale. So basically, these are they're microfluidic devices which allow you to have particles flow only through the active area of the Hall cross. And we would like to optimize that with blood samples, but we haven't really done that as yet. So let me now talk, how much more time do I have? 10 minutes? I was going to talk briefly about electrical sensors. I think I'll go through that rather more quickly. The same scheme applies. Basically, we can make field effect transistors, and once again, we can decorate them with molecules which then capture the molecules of interest. Here you can see these are all scanning electron micrographs of the small, very, very tiny nano belts that we use of various materials, which include indium arsenide and various others. And these are very small. As you can see, this is 200 nanometers, that scale over here. So this is probably less than 100 nanometers in width, and the thickness is on the tens of nanometer range. One can then take one of these and put it across a number of electrodes, and one can produce this kind of device, which is really a device which is a field effect transistor. And because it is so small, this little nano belt, that white thing there, if we place something on it, it will change how electrons go through the device. So it's part of a device which is really the basis for the field effect transistor, except in this case, because it is so small, even small amounts of changes in potential or something that we put on the surface of it may change quite drastically or measurably the current that goes through such a device. And I want to show that in the next slide. Here, this is room temperature sensing of hydrogen. And here's hydrogen, and here it goes back to air, and it goes back to hydrogen. It takes a long time because we have a very small amount of hydrogen when we're actually trying to do this experiment. But as you can see, the changes in the resistance of this device that I showed a moment ago are quite large. It depends only on having molecules of hydrogen attach themselves to the surface of this device. So these are very sensitive detectors. They depend on things being small. It would not happen if we had a very large one of these devices, because the change that would occur would be too small to measure. So then finally, I would like to talk about something that is sort of fun, and we're not very far with it. But, you know, there are such things as biomotors. This was one of the first ones that actually rotates. But there are biomotors that you're all familiar with because, you know, your muscles work that way. You have actin and myosin. So that's what I want to talk about. So this is an actin-myosin linear motor. And we want to see whether we can generate mechanical motion with a biomolecular motor. So here's this actin-myosin motor. Basically what happens is that the myosin walks on top of these actin filaments. But the things that I'm going to show you are really more like, you know, like one of these mosh pits, you know, where the rock star is being, you know, moved along like so. Because what we're doing is we're putting, you know, the myosin on the bottom and we're allowing the actin to move along. So it's the inverse of what you see there. And that's what you'll be able to observe. Now the scales here are very small. It's about 10 nanometers. And what we'd like to do is we'd like to build a metal nanorod on top of it and make it move because of the biomolecular motion that we can produce here with a fuel, which is called ATP. And the design is the following. Basically, what we're going to have is going to have a reservoir of that fuel, and we're going to have here some tracks which allow us to have the this nanorod move along those tracks. And then the question is, how can we make it move only in one direction? And how can we make it move in this direction as compared to the other direction? So these are all challenges that we have to try to meet. So the first thing is we have to be able to make nanorods. This is a nanorod, for example, of nickel with gold. And then we have to also make a sensor. We have to make a room temperature Hall sensor to be able to measure the motion of the nanorod. And that's why we use nickel, because we can measure the fringing magnetic fields of that nickel rod with the Hall sensors that I talked about a moment ago. We also need a myosin. You remember the myosin is this walking molecule, but it has to be relatively stable. So our first attempt is to look at a rather unfortunate fish that lives at relatively low temperatures. So we've taken this myosin. There's also rapid myosin, which is available. Of course, I don't do any of that. These are the venues of our biological friends. And then we have to be able to pattern some tracks which allow us to have the actin move along these tracks so that we can actually move this rod the way we want it. And it turns out that we can change the speed at which these motors run by changing their temperature slightly. And that's something that we found. So the rest of the time I'm just going to spend looking at a variety of these elements. So this is this nickel-gold nickel nanorod. We have made such nanorods. You can see them here. This is 1 micron, this scale, so the dimensions are that this is much smaller than a micron. And then we also have these gradiometers. So here is a nanorod on one of these gradiometers, on one of these Hall gradiometers, and this is actually the signal that one sees from such a nanorod that we've manufactured. So we can see the signal, certainly. And we can also calculate that if we look at the end of the rod as a function of position, we can actually see these changes. And now I want to show you what actin looks like. This is actin which has been labeled so that it's phosphorescent. And so if you do that, you can see that these things don't know where the heck they're going. You know, they're just going all over the place. And that won't do us any good because that's sort of random motion. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to be able to control the motion of these things. So these are the actin filaments here that you, that you see. I guess that's the end of it. So, and there have been various methods for doing that. The simplest method is actually to provide a physical barrier for these things to be able to run along. So the question is, can we make a physical barrier never mind about some of this other stuff, in which we only have these actin filaments run along here so that they don't climb over the barrier and go someplace else. And so that's what I want to show you now. This is the result of such barriers. And you see, for example, this one desperately wants to get out of that track, but it can't make it. It really can't make it, and it's torturing itself trying to get there. Anyway, that shows you where we are now. We have also been able to measure the motility, which is really the motion of these actin filaments, by changing the temperature. You do that in a conventional flow cell, which is really just a glass slide with a cover slide on top of it and then some spacers. And what we've done is we produced this relatively simple heater and temperature element that can be placed on top of it so that we can actually look through this window here, if you see it, and look at the phosphorescence, you know, of the filaments that are produced. And that can then be analyzed. And it turns out that the speed, and this is in microns per second, this is sort of the speed that goes, you can increase the speed, you can decrease the speed again, increase, decrease, depending on what temperature you're at. We can also analyze this data and find that it's basically what's called thermally activated. So the point is that we can, in fact, control the speed of the actin filaments. And we can do it even more rapidly than is shown here, as is shown in this bottom panel, where now instead of having minutes, we're talking in terms of seconds. Here's the speed. Well, all of a sudden it goes, we give it a temperature pulse, it goes to a much higher, and it's reversible. So I don't know where I am. Am I sort of, yeah. So what I've tried to show you is really just some examples of things which we and others are working on to try to find new science, which is absolutely necessary to attack some of the problems that we want to attack using small scales. And as we've said, you know, we've come a long way, baby, but as Richard Feynman said, there's an enormous amount that still needs to be done. Thank you very much.
That's great. We have about 15 minutes for questions before our next talk.
Yes?
I'm not sure on the actin, what is it?
Sorry?
The motility of the actin?
Yes. Well, the way they move, and I didn't show it there very well, it's actually the myosin which moves. It's the motor molecule. And it actually grabs on, and usually can only go in one direction. It's a rather complicated thing, but it actually has two arms. And they grab onto here, then they release, actually it's a complicated reaction where they release some chemicals, and then the next one comes and, you know, grabs on here. So it's this kind of motion. Now, what you're seeing is the opposite. You've got the myosin, which is the motor molecule, it's actually lying on the floor, right? And the actin filaments on which these things walk are actually above, and they are different lengths, as you saw. And what you're seeing is, you know, the myosin going like this, and that's because we can actually attach things to the actin, we can see it move. Yes? Well, you certainly saw differences. That's absolutely true. And the way these things are analyzed is that there are computer models which are used, which look at a whole set of all of these illuminated things, and then they take averages. So what you saw there was actually the average, not of just one long strand, but an average of what one sees. Yeah. Yes.
Other variables
In principle, I mean, this was just the first test because people know this happened to be a, I think this is a zinc oxide nanobelt that I showed there. And maybe it's tin oxide. I can't remember which one it was. But there's a lot of information about hydrogen sensing in the bulk from this type of material. And so what we wanted to do was, or what the people who actually did this, this was not I who did that, they wanted to see, what the sensitivity was for various doses of hydrogen if you make the device smaller. As you saw, it's really terrific. And that's because you can make these things smaller. In principle, the field effect transistor, which I didn't go into, and let me see if I can't find that. Now, if we have a few seconds, let me just see. Well, let me go up. No, this isn't doing anything. Oh, that's because it always has this stupid thing there. Yeah. Yeah. If you look at that, the normal field effect transistor, what happens is that, let me just bring this up again. So what we have in that case is the way these things really work is as follows. You have something which is a conductor, then you have on top of that an insulator, and this is actually the gate, the so-called gate for this belt. The belt sits on top of that. And what happens is ordinarily when you have such things, you can change by applying a voltage between here and here, you can change the potential and thereby either attract or repel electrons from this belt. And that leads to what's called an on-off ratio, which is what you see here. The gate voltage, when it's plus 20 volts, means that you have a very large current going from source to drain. And then if you put minus 20 volts, then you don't see anything at all. And this is just a cut of that that goes through here at some small voltage. This is at 3 volts. What's happening here? Yeah. So this is at 3 volts, and we're plotting here the source drain current as a function of gate voltage now. So it's just there's a locus of these spots of all of these curves. Right? So that's what we're observing. Now, if you were able to change the voltage of this thing in some other way, then you in principle could also change the current, and therefore you can measure the change in the resistance of the device. And that's what's done here. So, for example, what we have here is we have source drain. Here is what it looks like when we expose it to hydrogen. The current is much, much higher, which means that somehow it must be attracting electrons, since these are electron conductors, to the belt. And then if it's in air, this current is much, much smaller. And the sensitivity of the device depends on what you're putting on there and whether you can make that change. And so a long answer to your question is it should be possible to do this with a number of different things. It's just not hydrogen, except that hydrogen is something that's been studied in great detail. And what we were able to show here, and that's really the point of this curve, is that we were able to make this operate at room temperature. Ordinarily, sensors like this have to be actually heated some before you can make them sensitive. Yes?
Along this line, do you see an application of this for
Well, in principle, there may be such a thing. I mean, it would require in that case that we actually have the same kind of scenario that I showed for this biological, you know, stuff, so that you have some sort of recognizer molecule, then the stuff that you want to, you know, anthrax or something, that you then can grab a hold of that, which will then change the transport of the device. But we have certainly not done that yet. So, but that's the hope is... that we may be able to use this for biological sensing as well. Yeah.
Is the difference here between the greater dipole moment of air and...
Well, that's a very good question. It's not entirely known, but basically what needs to be done is you somehow have to change the local potential so that you can either attract or repel electrons from that surface, thereby changing it. And we don't know the exact mechanism for that as yet. But the reason that you see a change is because you're changing the potential locally. But how that potential changes, yeah. Yeah. All I can say is that for these nano devices, the only thing that's really been tested so far, at least in the ones that we've made, has been for hydrogen, because it's been a big challenge technologically to try to make something that looks like that when you're using a nano belt, as you can see over here. This is one of these guys, right? So the nano belt, you know, I don't think you can see that. That's 10 microns. So this nanobelt is very, very small, as I showed you a moment ago. So the technological challenges are enormous. And so this was really just a test case to show that when you have a small device like that, that you can use it for these type of purposes. Yes?
Why would you first think of trying to put different molecules in this going? And this is trying to get what students understand how scientists are. So it's not some random, I'm allowed, I think, I'll put 200 molecules. So why would you think of doing that?
You mean the hydrogen and these things? As I mentioned to you, hydrogen sensors are very important, and people have used zinc oxide, hydrogen, I think it's tin oxide actually, hydrogen sensors for some time. So we actually just copied what people already have technologically. In terms of choosing molecules, for instance, for biomolecules, there is an enormous library of various proteins which are released for various illnesses. And our biological friends are very keen on us being able to take very small samples of blood and being able to recognize specific molecules. And the strategy there is, again, one that I am not an expert in, but it requires the actual binding of the molecule, which is the one we want to detect, to a recognizer molecule, which we can place directly onto the sensor. So the motivation there is to try to detect something which is of perhaps health importance, or it's perhaps important for homeland security, although that's not something I've thought about specifically, personally, that much. Then the strategy is to find the kind of chemistry which allows us then to bind that in an efficient way and a recognizable way to the sensor surface itself. And there are a lot of challenges in that. You know, this is not this is still at the beginning, because you may actually have wrong readings. You don't want that, right? If a guy, you know, comes to you and he wants to get tested and they say, oh, geez, you've had a heart attack or you're about to have one, you don't want to say, oh, excuse me, no, that's not really what I... Everything's okay. So there are lots of things like that that have not as yet been answered. Yes? Very carefully? No. Usually what is done is one puts them into solution. People have done in the past is that they've actually made a number of these types of electrodes on a surface, then put either one of these nanobelts in solution and hope that one of them, you know, falls on the device. But That is done. That's what many people do nowadays in order to study these small devices. What we are doing, and I'm not talking about that here, is that members of our group, a man named Peng Zhang, has developed self-assembled strategies which actually allow him to put a single one of these fibers directly onto the electrode that he wants. And what he does is that, again, you know, he has areas which will reject such nanobells, and then areas which will attract them. And he's done that very successfully, for instance, in carbon nanotubes. That's actually the greatest success he's had. Rather than using these nanobells, you have nanotubes. You've heard about carbon nanotubes, have you? You know, these come in various sizes and in various types. You can have conducting ones and non-conducting ones. For these types of purposes, one wants to have non-conducting, semiconducting ones.
So would he sensitize the actual tubule itself or the mechanism? Or both?
In their case, what they actually do is they first, I don't have the slides here with me, but I can tell you briefly. What happens is that you can make stripes, and here is where, you know, the stuff doesn't want to go, and here is where it wants to go. And then they can make these stripes, and then they can flow a solution over them, and then they can actually cut them so that they have only one place for these stripes to go. I mean, for the carbon nanotube to go. And then usually what happens is that you have a series of carbon nanotubes over a small area. And when you do that, then you can measure either one or a bundle of those. And the one thing that they've done, which is really tremendous, is they've made FETs using this sort of self-assembly process, which are better than anything that's been published so far. And furthermore, they don't have hysteresis, which is one of the things that that carbon nanotubes, FETs, at the moment suffer from to a large extent.
I think at this point we need to move on to our second speaker, but before we do that, let's thank Professor von Molnar.